I got into a conversation a while back with a person who thought that Christians shouldn't be the kind of people to get angry. And I suggested to that person, I'm not sure that I'm right, but I suggested to that person that Jesus tended to get angry at certain things, and that when he was in the temple and he overchanged the tables of the money changers, that he was angry, and that Jesus himself says some things about anger, and that anger is a tough thing because it's an emotion. It's something that you don't control. All of a sudden, it's something that sneaks up on you and you're angry. Yet this person seemed to suggest to me that we should be so nice, Christians should be so nice, that butter wouldn't melt in our mouths, and there's really nothing in the world that is too great to have a sunny disposition about. You know, that there aren't things to get angry about. Everything will work out in the end. Yet the older I get, the more I really get angry at certain things. I really hate some things, and I'm not too sure that God would judge me for hating some of these things. As a young pastor, funerals were part of my job. It was just a duty. Now, I cared for the people. Don't miss me. Don't get me wrong. I cared for the people whose funerals I did, but it was something that happened. It was something that came with the territory. Yet after almost 20 years of doing this, you'd think it would get easier, but it doesn't. I hate death now more than I hated it when I started. I really deal with it less well than when I was younger. And I think the reason that I hate it is because I have seen so many people's lives affected by it. I've seen widows fall apart. I've seen grandchildren weeping uncontrollably. I've seen friends die before their time. And I really, really hate death and what it does to people. And I hate to read about children who are starving to death in some country where they could be fed, but because the political system can't get it together and people are greedy and corporations are greedy and they keep all the money concentrated in one area, that children are starving, even though there's food to be had. And I hate to hear stories of random violence. I hate to hear stories of people's lives ripped apart. And I'm not too sure anymore that we're not supposed to hate. Of course, we're never to hate people. Jesus talks about turning the other cheek and loving the enemy. I'm certain that we're not supposed to hate people, but I'm not too certain that it's wrong to hate what the Romans did to Jesus. I'm not too sure that it's wrong to hate the fact that we must die. Is it really wrong to hate the fact that from the moment Jesus came to live a life in Bethlehem, the moment that he became human to live life on earth, bone of our bone and flesh of our flesh, that God knew from that moment on, God the Father knew that there's going to be suffering and that there's only one way for his son to get out of life, and that would be, as the Bible calls it, the last enemy, death. And that's why Easter has become so important to my way of thinking. It's always been important. But if we really study what's going on, Easter is about death being run out of town. Easter is proclaiming that hospice beds and blood pressure drugs and tombstones and funerals are on their last legs and that they're going out of business and that Jesus has notified them that they are going away and are going away forever. Why does Mary come to the graveyard on Easter Sunday? Maybe she comes out of a sense of obligation. Maybe Mary Magdalene wants to make right the desecration of Jesus' body on that cross. While he was alive and while his corpse was being abused once he had died, while he was mocked by the Romans. After all, Jesus died a criminal's death. They didn't use the cross for a death of noble people. They didn't use a cross for a death of one who was well known. They used it for the most miserable in society. Jesus died a criminal's death, and he was buried in a borrowed tomb with no funeral. They had to go and find somebody to donate the tomb, and they just buried him in it without any service whatsoever. I remember many years back getting a call from a funeral director asking me to do a funeral for a gentleman who had died. And the funeral director told me that this man was a drifter. He had no relatives who wanted anything to do with him, even in death. So the funeral director had called around and he had found a cemetery that was willing to bury him gratis, without a cost. And he found a stonemason who had donated the stone and the time it would take to etch it. And he asked if I would do something at the graveside, because he said, I just can't imagine putting this man in the ground without somebody doing something for him. And that's exactly what we did. It was a few of us strangers to this man. I had never met him. And we said a prayer at his graveside to add some dignity to his burial. Mary comes to do exactly the same. She wants to wring whatever dignity is left out of Jesus' death. She wants to do that little thing that was denied to Jesus in his life. She wants to do something out of compassion and holiness and love for her Lord. Yet when she gets there, it seems like the indignities only continue. She gets there and she finds that the giant boulder that has been rolled against the stone has been rolled away, and that the grave looks empty, and that it looks like somebody has broken into the tomb and stolen Jesus' body. One last indignity upon many indignities during Holy Week. And in a panic, Mary hurries to find her friends and Jesus' disciples. She finds Peter and John and says to them, they've taken the Lord Jesus out of the tomb. What are we going to do now? Peter and John are as shocked as Mary is at the news. They run off to see for themselves. They're not thinking of resurrection yet. They're thinking, oh no, not again, not this time, not one more thing. Mary stays in the garden. Perhaps she's in shock. Perhaps she's desperate for an answer. She investigates the tomb. She looks inside again. Maybe the grave robbers have left some sort of sign of where they took the Lord. Maybe they've left a clue. And upon looking into the tomb, she sees two figures. We're told that they're angels, but I don't know if Mary knew. She asks them for the body of Jesus. She says, they've taken away my Lord, and I do not know where they have laid him. Just let me know where he is, and I'll take care of him. I'll take care of the funeral arrangements. She walks among the graves. She walks among the tombs. She walks among this place of death, only to see in the half light of dawn a man she thinks is the gardener. Mary clearly thinks that he has probably disturbed the body, perhaps because Jesus died poor and in a pauper's grave. Perhaps he moved the body into a different tomb, into another spot, because he didn't pay his bills. He wasn't current with his account. So Mary says to this gardener in the half light of dawn, sir, if you have carried him away, tell me what you have done, and let me make this right. Yet the interesting thing is that this gardener is no gardener, but is, of course, Jesus of Nazareth. And he says to her and calls out to her, her name, Mary. The interesting thing about the risen Jesus is that he doesn't stay put. From Bethlehem to Nazareth, from Jerusalem to Bethany, from Cairo to New York, from Pretoria to Beijing, Jesus is going into our sinful world and uprooting the hate in our hearts so that we can encounter the risen Lord. George MacLeod, a Scottish war hero and pastor from the 20th century, wrote about this traveling risen Jesus. He said this, he said, Jesus was not crucified in a cathedral between two candles, but rather on a cross between two thieves, on a town garbage heap, at a crossroads so cosmopolitan they had to write his title in Hebrew and in Latin and in Greek. It was the kind of place where cynics talked smut, thieves cursed, and soldiers gambled. But it was where he died, and it's what he died about. You see, if Easter tells us anything, it tells us that Jesus cannot stay in the tomb, and he never could. Mary was not dealing with a dead body. And the resurrection appearances didn't happen in a church, but it happened out there in the world. What this tells us is that wherever we felt bound, wherever we felt tied down by our hate, by our hopelessness, Jesus is there. Jesus shows up in places we don't want him sometimes, but we need him. Jesus shows up in places where we least expect him, in the checkbook or bank account, in family life, or how you spend your free time. Easter is about so much more than we can ask or think. The resurrection of Jesus is not just some historical event like 1066 or 1492 that you can teach children and then point out, well, this is something you have to memorize in order to pass a class. Nor is Easter a holiday about ham and eggs, but it is an event, a reality, right here and right now. The risen Jesus is a reality right now in our hearts and in our minds and in this world. We've all seen recently where our world has been in need of hearing a good word of healing. And pastors and community leaders were instrumental to the rally on Tuesday night for Franklin Regional. The violence that we had heard of or been witness to tears at our community. And people want to hear a word of hope. And the invocation on Tuesday night, the message was that we can all make an impact. That we can all do something that pleases God in the face of unimaginable violence. We can all do something, even if it's small. Maybe it's forgiveness, or maybe it's compassion, or maybe it's listening. But we are not helpless, and we can contribute. And I would say that that is one of the important messages of Easter, that we are called to do something, that God has called us to do something, that we have been called by God to blossom where we've been planted. We're not to click our tongues in anger or in hatred and say, you know what, that's somebody else's problem. But rather, the risen Christ approaches us and says, how are you going to take responsibility? How are you going to make an impact? The risen Christ approaches Mary by name. Mary couldn't find him in the tomb or on the cross, but Jesus found her first. That's the real irony of this story. Mary, who looks every place for him, doesn't find him. Jesus finds Mary. Jesus finds those of us who stray. Jesus finds us when we feel unspiritual or when we're lonely, when we're rich or when we're poor. Jesus finds us where we are and Jesus comes to us. Whether it's in the supper or in the world or in the garden or on the street or in the airport or bus station. Jesus comes to us when children are running to and fro with Easter baskets searching for eggs or in the college dormitory. Jesus comes to us in bread and cup. C.S. Lewis, the Christian author who wrote the children's book, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, also wrote many books for adults, and in one of them he wrote that the command of Jesus in communion is to take and eat, not to take and understand. So we are never removed from this mysterious risen Christ unless we choose to remove ourselves, unless we choose to ignore him. Instead, he always comes to us. His kingdom is worldwide, and Jesus reigns wherever Jesus chooses to reign. The risen Jesus reminds us who we are, and he removes our hates, he transforms our frustrations into love and hope. And the risen Jesus doesn't stay in the garden either. He moves on from there. The resurrection, the first resurrection appearance, it happens in the garden. But notice, right after that, Jesus is in other places quite quickly. He meets with his disciples in an upper room. He meets with his disciples for a simple meal of fish on the seashore. Jesus comes to us in our anger and in our hopelessness. He emerges out of great hatred and woundedness. Jesus is present at this table with this bread and with this cup. He is present with our neighbors and our friends next to us in the pews. Christ is risen. Christ is risen indeed. Amen.